powered slugs in the engine block would do the job. Then he could start shooting through the windows. He probably wouldn't get them all, not with the sun glaring on the glass, but the ones who were left would come spilling out into the empty parking lot, maybe wounded, dazed for sure. His finger curled on the trigger, but before he could fire the first shot, the SUV stopped on its own near the abandoned gift shop with its fallen sign. The doors opened. "Thank you, God," Jack murmured. He applied his eye to the scope again, waiting for Mr. No Opinion to emerge. They all had to go, but the chief meddler was going first. 11. The Diamondback emerged from the crack where it had taken refuge. It slithered toward Jack's splayed feet, stopped, tasted the warming air with its flickering tongue, then slithered forward again. It had no intention of attacking. Its purpose was only investigatory. But when Jack fired the first shot, it raised its tail and began to rattle. Jack, who had forgotten shooter's plugs or cotton for his ears as well as his toothbrush, never heard it. 12. Howie was the first out of the SUV. He stood with his hands on his hips, surveying the fallen sign reading, "Souvenirs and Authentic Indian Crafts." Alec and Yoon exited the back seat on the driver's side. Ralph got out of the shotgun seat to open the rear door for Holly, who was having trouble with the handle. As he did this, something lying on the cracked pavement caught his eye. "Damn," he said. "Look at that."
"What is it?" Holly asked as he bent down.
"What?
What?"
"I think it's an arrowhead." A gunshot rang out, the almost liquid whip crack of a high-powered rifle. Ralph felt the passage of the slug, which meant it had missed the top of his head by no more than an inch or two. The SUV's passenger side mirror shattered and flew away, hitting the cracked asphalt and tumbling across it in a series of brilliant flashes.
"Gun!"
Ralph shouted, grabbing Holly around her shoulders and dragging her to her knees.
"Gun! Gun! Gun!"
Howie looked around at him. His expression was both startled and bemused.
"Say what? Did you?"
The second shot came, and the top of Howie Gold's head disappeared. For a moment he stood where he was, blood coursing down his cheeks and brow. Then he toppled. Alec ran toward him, and the third shot came, throwing Alec back against the hood of the SUV. Blood burst through his shirt above the belt line. Yoon started toward him. There was a fourth shot. Ralph saw it tear away the side of Alec's neck, and then Howie's investigator dropped out of sight behind the car.
"Get down!"
Ralph shouted at Yoon.
"Get down! He's up on that bluff!"
Yoon dropped to his knees and scrambled. Three more shots came in rapid succession. One of the SUV's tires began to hiss. The windshield cracked into a milk glaze and sagged in around a hole above the steering wheel. The third shot punched through the rear quarter panel on the driver's side and blew an exit hole as big as a tennis ball on the passenger side, close to where Ralph and Yoon now crouched, flanking Holly. There was a pause. Then another fusillade, four shots this time. The rear windows broke, spraying nuggets of safety glass. Another of those ragged holes appeared in the rear deck.
"We can't stay here," Holly said.
She sounded perfectly calm.
"Even if he doesn't hit us, he'll hit the gas tank."
"She's right," Yoon said. "Alec and Gold, what do you think? Any chance?" "No," Ralph said. "They're another of those liquid whip cracks." They all flinched, and another tire began to hiss. "They're gone," Ralph finished. "We have to run for that souvenir shop. You two go first. I'll cover you." "I'll do the covering," Yoon said. "You and Holly do the running." A scream came from the shooter's position. Of pain or rage, Ralph couldn't tell. Yoon stood up, legs spread, pistol held in both hands, and began to fire spaced shots at the top of the knoll.
"Go!"
he shouted.
"Right now! Go, go, go!"
Ralph stood up. Holly stood up beside him. As on the day when Terry Maitland was shot, it seemed to Ralph that he could see everything. His arm was around Holly's waist. There was a bird circling in the sky, wings outstretched. The tires were hissing. The SUV was settling on the driver's side. At the top of the knoll, he could see a stuttery, moving flash that had to be the scope of the bastard's rifle. Ralph had no idea why it was moving around like that and didn't care. There was a second scream, then a third, the last one almost a shriek. Holly grabbed Yoon's arm and jerked him. He gave her an amazed look, like a man rudely yanked out of a dream, and Ralph knew he had been ready to die, expected to die. The three of them sprinted for the shelter of the gift shop, and although it had to be less than 200 feet from the mortally wounded SUV, they seemed to be running in slow motion, like a trio of best friends at the end of some stupid romantic comedy. Only in those movies, no one ran past the mangled bodies of two men who had been alive and healthy only 90 seconds before. In those movies, no one stepped in a puddle of fresh blood and left bright red tracks behind. Another shot rang out, and Yoon shouted, "I'm hit! Fucker hit me!" He went down. 13. Jack was reloading, his ears ringing, when the rattlesnake decided it had enough of this bothersome intruder in its territory. It struck him high on the right calf. Its fangs penetrated Jack's chino pants with no trouble at all, and its poison sacks were full. Jack rolled over, holding his rifle high in his right hand, screaming, not at the pain which was just beginning, but at the sight of the rattler slithering up his leg, its forked tongue flicking, its beady black eyes intent. The slippery weight of it was hideous. It struck him again, this time in the thigh, and continued its sinuous upward trek, still rattling away. The next strike might be into his balls. "Get off! Get the fuck off me!" Trying to get rid of it with the rifle would do no good. It could evade that. So Jack dropped the gun and seized it in both hands. It struck at his right wrist, missing the first time, but hitting on its second try, leaving holes the size of colons in a newspaper headline. But its poison sacks were exhausted. Jack neither knew nor cared. He twisted it in his hands like a man wringing out a washcloth and saw its skin split. Down below, someone was firing repeatedly, a pistol by the sound. But the range was long and nothing came close. Jack flung the rattlesnake, saw it thump to the rocky scree and slither away once more.
"Get rid of them, Jack."
"Yes, okay, right." Was he speaking or only thinking? He couldn't tell. The ringing in his ears had become a high hum, like a steel wire being stroked until it vibrated. He grabbed the rifle, rolled onto his belly, placed the barrel back on the flat rock, peered into the scope. The remaining three were running for the shelter of the gift shop, the woman in the middle. He tried to put the crosshairs on Anderson, but his hands, one of them repeatedly snake-bitten, were trembling, and he got the olive-skinned guy on the end instead. It took 2 tries, but he got him. The guy's arm flew back over his head like a pitcher getting ready to throw his best fastball, and he fell on his side. The other two stopped to help him. This was his best chance, and maybe the last. If he didn't take them now, they'd get behind the building. Pain was flowing up his leg from the initial bite, and he could feel the flesh of his calf swelling. But that wasn't the worst part. The worst part was the heat that was now spreading like a flash fever, or the sunburn from hell. He fired again and thought at first he'd hit the woman, but it was only a flinch. She grabbed the olive-skinned man by his unwounded arm. Anderson got him around the waist and yanked him to his feet. Jack pulled the trigger again and got nothing but a dry click. He fumbled in his pocket for more shells, loaded 2, dropped the rest. His hands were going numb. The leg that had been bitten was going numb. His tongue seemed to be swelling in his mouth. He screamed again, this time in frustration. By the time he applied his eye to the scope again, they were gone. He could see their shadows for a moment, and then those were gone, too.
14. With Holly on one side and Ralph on the other,
Yoon was able to make it to the splintered side of the gift shop where he collapsed with his back against the building, panting. His face was ashy, his forehead dotted with pearls of sweat. The left sleeve of his shirt was bloody down to the wrist. He groaned.
Fuck! Doesn't that fucking smart?
From the knoll, the shooter fired again. The bullet whined off the asphalt.
How bad? Ralph said. Let me see.
He unbuttoned Yoon's cuff, and although he pulled the sleeve up gently, Yoon yelped and bared his teeth. Holly was on her cell phone. When the wound was revealed, it didn't look as bad as Ralph had feared. The bullet had probably done little more than crease him. In a movie, that would have left Yoon ready to rejoin the fray, but this was real life, and real life was different. The high-powered slug had gotten enough of him to do a job on his elbow. The flesh around it was already swelling, turning purple, as if it had been smashed with a club.
"Tell me the elbow's only dislocated,"
Yoon said. "That would be good, but I think it's broken," Ralph said. "You still lucked out, man. If it had gotten any more of you, I think it would have torn your lower arm right off. I don't know what he's shooting, but it's big."
"My shoulder's dislocated for sure," Yoon said. "Happened when my arm whipped back. Fuck! What are we going to do, amigo? We're pinned."
"Holly?" Ralph asked. "Anything?"
She shook her head. "I had 4 bars at the Boltons, but not even one here. Get off me, is what he shouted. Did either of you hear?"
The rifleman fired again. Alec Pelley's body jumped, then lay still.
"I'll get you, Anderson,"
came floating down from the top of the knoll.
"I'll get you, Ralphie boy. I'll get all of you."
Yoon looked at Ralph, startled. "We messed up," Holly said. "The outsider had a Renfield, after all. And whoever he is, he knows you, Ralph. Do you know him?"
Ralph shook his head. The shooter had been yelling at the top of his voice, almost howling, and there were echoes. It could have been anyone. Yoon studied his wounded arm. The bleeding had slowed, but the swelling hadn't. Soon he would have no appreciable elbow joint at all.
"This hurts worse than when my wisdom teeth went to hell. Tell me you have an idea, Ralph."
Ralph scooted to the far end of the building, cupped his hands around his mouth and shouted,
"The police are on their way, asshole! The highway patrol! Those guys won't bother asking you to surrender. They'll shoot you like a rabid dog. If you want to live, you better run for it."
There was a pause, then another scream. It might have been pain, laughter, or both. It was followed by 2 more shots. One thumped into the building above Ralph's head, knocking a board loose and sending up a flurry of splinters. Ralph pulled back and looked at the other 2 ambush survivors. "I think that was a no."
"He sounds hysterical," Holly said.
"Out of his mind," Yoon agreed. He put his head back against the wall. "Christ, it's hot on this asphalt. It'll be a lot hotter by noon.
Muy caliente.
If we're still here, we'll bake." Holly said, "Do you shoot with your right hand, Lieutenant Saplo?"
"Yes, and since we're pinned down by a lunatic with a rifle, why don't you just go on and call me Yoon like El Jefe here?"
"You need to get over to the end of the building where Ralph is, and Ralph, you need to get over here with me. When Lieutenant Saplo starts shooting, we'll run for the road that goes to the tourist cabins and the Ahiga entrance. I estimate we'll be in the open for no more than 50 yards. We can cover that in 15 seconds, maybe 12.
12 seconds could be enough for him to get one of us, Holly.
I think we can make it.
Still as cool as the breeze from a fan blowing over a bowl of ice cubes. It was amazing. When she'd come into Howie's conference room 2 nights ago, she'd been so tightly wrapped that a loud cough might have had her leaping for the ceiling. She's been in situations like this before, Ralph thought, and maybe it's in situations like this where the real Holly Gibney comes out. Another gunshot, followed by a spang of metal, then another.
"He's shooting for the SUV's gas tank," Yoon said. "The rental people won't like that." "We have to go, Ralph."
Holly was staring directly into his eyes. Another thing she'd had trouble with before, but not now. No, not now.
Think of all the Frank Petersons. He'll murder if we let him get away. They'll go with him because they think they know him, or because he seems friendly, the way he must have seemed friendly to the Howard girls. Not the one up there. I mean the one he's protecting.
3 more shots in rapid succession. Ralph saw holes appear low on the SUV's rear quarter panel. Yes, he was aiming for the gas tank. And what are we supposed to do if Mr. Renfield comes down to meet us? Ralph asked.
Maybe he won't. Maybe he'll stay where he is, on the high ground. We only have to go as far as the path that leads to the Ahiga entrance. If he comes down before we can get there, you can shoot him.
Happy to if he doesn't shoot me first.
I think there might be something wrong with him, Holly said. Those screams.
You nodded. Get off me, I heard it too.
The next gunshot ruptured the SUV's tank and gasoline began to pour onto the asphalt. There was no immediate explosion, but if the guy on the knoll hit the tank again, the SUV would almost certainly blow.
Okay, Ralph said. The only alternative he could see was crouching here and waiting for the outsider's accomplice to start pumping high-velocity slugs directly through the gift shop, trying to take out one or more of them that way. Yoon, give us as much cover as you can.
Yoon edged to the corner of the building, hissing with pain at each sliding movement. He held his Glock against his chest with his right hand. Holly and Ralph moved to the other end. Ralph could see the service road leading up the hill into the tourist cabins. It was flanked by a pair of large boulders. An American flag was painted on one, the Texas Lone Star flag on the other. Once we get behind the one with the American flag on it, we should be safe. Almost certainly true, but 50 yards had never looked so much like 500. He thought of Jeannie at home doing her yoga or downtown running errands. He thought of Derek at camp, maybe in the craft room with his new buds talking about TV shows, video games, or girls. He even had time to wonder who Holly was thinking about. Him, apparently.
Are you ready?
Before he could reply, the shooter fired again and the SUV's gas tank exploded in a ball of orange fire. Yoon leaned out from his corner and began shooting at the top of the knoll. Holly sprinted. Ralph followed. 15. Jack saw the SUV burst into flame and screamed in triumph. Although it made no sense to do so, it wasn't as though there was anyone in it. Then movement caught his eye, and he saw 2 of the meddlers running for the service road. The woman was in the lead, Anderson right behind her. Jack swung his rifle toward them and sighted through the scope. Before he could pull the trigger, there was the zzz of an incoming round. Rock chip struck his shoulder. The one they'd left behind was shooting, and although the range was far too long for accuracy with whatever handgun the guy was using, the last one had been too close for comfort. Jack ducked, and as his chin pressed down on his neck, he felt the glands there bulge and throb, as if they were loaded with pus. His head was aching, his skin was sizzling, and his eyes seemed too big for their sockets. He peered through the scope just in time to glimpse Anderson disappearing behind one of those big boulders. He had lost them. Nor was that all. Black smoke was rising from the burning SUV, and now that it was full day, there was no wind to disperse it. What if someone saw that and called whatever excuse for a volunteer fire department they had in this poor-ass town?
Go down.
No need to question whose voice it was this time.
You need to get to them before they can get to the Ahiga Pass.
Jack had no idea what an Ahiga was. But he had no doubt what the visitor inside his head was talking about. The path marked by the sign showing Chief Wahoo. He cringed as another bullet from the asshole down there spanked rock chips from a nearby outcropping, took the first step back the way he had come, and fell down. For a moment, pain obliterated all thought. Then he grabbed at a bush sticking out between 2 rocks and pulled himself up. He looked down at himself. At first, unable to believe what had become of him. The leg the snake had bitten now looked 2 times as big as the other one. The cloth of his pants was pulled tight. Worse, his crotch was bulging. It was as if he had stuffed a small pillow in there.
Go down, Jack. Get them, and I'll take the cancer away.
Oh, but right now he had more immediate concerns, didn't he? He was swelling up like a waterlogged sponge.
The snake bite poison, too. I can make you well.
Jack wasn't sure he could believe Tat Man, but he understood he had no choice. Also, there was Anderson. Mr. No Opinion didn't get to walk away from this. It was all his fault, and he didn't get to walk away. He started down the path at a shambling trot, clutching the barrel of the Winchester and using the stock as a cane. His second fall came when the rocky scree slid away under his left foot and his swollen, throbbing right leg wasn't able to compensate. The leg of his pad split open the next time he went down, disclosing flesh that was turning purplish-black and necrotic. He clawed at the rocks and got to his feet again, his face puffing and running with sweat. He was pretty sure he was going to die on this godforsaken chunk of rock and weeds, but he was goddamned if he was going to do it alone.
16. Ralph and Holly ran up the spur road, bent double, heads tucked. At the top of the first hill, they stopped to catch their breath. Below and to the left, they could see the circle of decaying tourist cabins. To the right was a long building, probably storage for equipment and supplies back when the Marysville hole had been a going concern. A truck was parked beside it. Ralph looked at it, looked away, then snapped back. Oh, my Christ.
What?
What?
No wonder he knew me. That's Jack Hoskins' truck.
Hoskins? The other detective from Flint City?
Yes, him.
Why would he?
Then she shook her head hard enough to make her bangs fly.
It doesn't matter. He stopped shooting, and that means he's probably coming. We need to go.
Maybe Yoon hit him, Ralph said, and when she gave him a disbelieving look, yeah, okay. They hurried past the equipment building. There was another path on the far side leading up the backside of the knoll.
I go first, Ralph said. I'm the one with the gun.
Holly didn't argue. They trotted up the incline, the narrow path twisting and turning. Loose scree slid and grated under their shoes, threatening to spill them. 2 or 3 minutes into the climb, Ralph began to hear the clatter and bounce of rocks somewhere higher up. Hoskins was indeed coming to meet them. They rounded an outcropping, Ralph with his Glock leveled, Holly behind him and on his right. The next stretch of the path ran straight for 50 feet or so. The sound of Hoskins' descent was louder now, but the maze of rocks made it impossible to tell just how close he was.
Where's the goddamn spur path that goes to the back entrance? Ralph asked.
He's getting closer. This is too much like playing chicken in that James Dean movie.
Yes, rebel without a cause.
I don't know,
but it can't be far.
If we run into him before we get off Main Street here, there's going to be shooting and ricochets. The minute you see him, I want you to drop.
She thumped him on the back.
If we beat him to the path, there won't be any shooting, and I won't have to.
Go!
Ralph ran up the straight stretch, telling himself he'd caught a second wind. It wasn't true, but it was good to stay positive. Holly was behind him and whapping him on the shoulder, either to hurry him along or to assure him that she was still there. They reached the next turning in the path. Ralph peered around it, expecting to look into the muzzle of Hoskins' rifle. He didn't see that, but he did see a wooden sign with Chief Ahiga's fading portrait on it.
Come on, he said. Fast!
They ran for the sign. And now Ralph could hear the oncoming shooter gasping for breath, almost sobbing for it. There was a rattle of stones and a cry of pain. It sounded like Hoskins had fallen down.
Good. Stay down.
But then the clattery, slip-sliding footsteps resumed. Very near. Closing in, Ralph grabbed Holly and pushed her onto the Ahiga path. Her small, pale face was running with sweat. Her lips were pressed tightly together, and her hands were buried in the pockets of her suit coat, which was now powdered with rock dust and
splattered with blood. Ralph raised a finger to his lips. She nodded. He stepped behind the sign. The dry Texas heat had caused the boards to shrink a bit, and he was able to peer through one of the cracks. He saw Hoskins as he staggered into view. His first thought was that Yoon had gotten lucky and put a bullet in him after all, but that didn't explain Hoskins' split pants and grotesquely swollen right leg. No wonder he fell, Ralph thought. It was amazing that he'd gotten this far down the steep path on that leg. He still had the rifle he'd used to kill Gold and Pelly, but was using it as a cane, and his fingers were nowhere near the trigger. Ralph didn't know if he would be able to hit anything anyway, even at close range. Not the way his hands were trembling. His bloodshot eyes were deep in their sockets. Rock dust had turned his face into a kabuki mask, but where perspiration had cut trails through it, the skin was red, as if with a terrible rash. Ralph stepped out from behind the sign Glock held in both hands.
"Stop right there, Jack, and let go of the rifle."
Jack skidded and stumbled to a halt 30 feet away, but he continued to hold the rifle by the barrel. That wasn't okay, but Ralph could live with it. If Hoskins started to raise it, however, his life was going to end.
"You shouldn't be here," Jack said. "Like my old granddad used to say, was you born dumb, or did you just grow that way?"
"I have no appetite for your bullshit. You killed 2 men and wounded another one, shot them from ambush."
"They never should have come here," Jack said. "But since they did, they got what they deserved for messing in with what didn't concern them."
"And what would that be, Mr. Hoskins?" Holly asked.
Hoskins' lips cracked and oozed tiny beads of blood when he smiled.
"Tat man, as I think you know, meddling bitch."
"Okay, now that you've got that out of your system," Ralph said, "put the rifle down. You've done enough damage with it. Just drop it. If you bend over, you'll fall on your face. Was it a snake that got you?"
"The snake was just a little extra. You need to leave, Ralph. Both of you need to leave, or else he poisons you like he poisoned me. A word to the wise."
Holly took a step closer to Jack. "How did he poison you?"
Ralph put a warning hand on her arm.
"Just touched me. Back of the neck. That was all it took."
He shook his head in tired wonder.
"How did that barn in Canning Township?"
His voice rose, trembling with outrage.
"Where you sent me?"
Ralph shook his head. "It must have been the chief, Jack. I didn't know anything about it. I'm not going to tell you again to put the gun down. You're done with this." Jack considered, or seemed to. Then he lifted the rifle very slowly, going hand over hand down the barrel toward the trigger housing.
"I'm not going the way my mother did. No, sir, I am not. I'll shoot your friend there first, Ralph, then you. Unless you stop me."
"Jack, don't. Last warning."
"Stick your warning up your—"
He was trying to point the gun at Holly. She didn't move. Ralph stepped in front of her and fired 3 times, the reports deafening in the tight space. One for Howie, one for Alec, one for Yoon. The distance was a trifle long for a pistol, but the Glock was a good gun, and he'd never had any trouble qualifying on the range. Jack Hoskins went down, and to Ralph, the expression on his dying face looked like relief.
17. Ralph sat down on a jutting lip of rock across from the sign, breathing hard. Holly went to Hoskins, knelt, and rolled him over. She had a look, then came back. "He was bitten more than once."
"Must have been a rattler, and a big one."
"Something else poisoned him first. Something worse than any snake. He called it Tat Man. We call it the Outsider."
El Cuco. We need to finish this. Ralph thought of Howie and Alec, lying dead on the other side of this godforsaken chunk of rock. They had families. And Yoon, still alive but wounded, suffering, probably in shock by now, also had a family. I suppose you're right. Want this pistol? I can take his rifle if you do. Holly shook her head. All right, let's do this. 18. Past the first turning, the Ahiga path widened and began to descend. There were pictographs on both sides. Some of the ancient images had been embellished or entirely covered with spray paint tags. "He'll know we're coming," Holly said. "I know. We should have brought one of those flashes." She reached into one of her voluminous side pockets, the one that had been sagging, and pulled out one of the stubby Home Depot UV flashlights. "You're sort of amazing," Ralph said. "I don't suppose you've got a couple of hard hats in there, do you?"
"No offense, but your sense of humor is a little weak, Ralph. You should work on that."
Around the next turning of the path, they came to a natural hollow in the rock about 4 feet off the ground. Above it, fading letters in black paint read, "We will never forget." Inside the niche was a dusty vase with thin branches jutting from it like skeletal fingers. The petals that had once adorned those branches were long gone, but something else remained. Scattered around the bottom of the vase were half a dozen toy versions of Chief Ahiga, like the one that had been left behind when the Jameson twins had crawled into the bowels of the earth, never to be found. The toys were yellow with age, and the sun had cracked the plastic.
"People have been here," Holly said. "Kids, I'd say, based on the spray paint tags. But they never vandalized this."
"Never even touched it from the look," Ralph said. "Come on. Yoon's on the other side with a bullet wound and a busted elbow."
"Yes, and I'm sure he's in great pain. But we need to be careful. That means moving slowly."
Ralph took her by the elbow. "If this guy gets both of us, that leaves Yoon on his own. Maybe you should go back."
She pointed to the sky, where black smoke from the burning SUV was rising.
"Someone will see that, and they'll come. And if something happens to us, Yoon's the only one who will know why."
She shook his hand loose and began walking up the path. Ralph spared one more look for the little shrine, undisturbed all these years, and then followed her. 19. Just when Ralph thought the Ahiga path was going to lead them to nowhere but the back of the gift shop, it took an acute left-hand turn, almost doubling back on itself, and ended at what looked for all the world like the entrance to some suburbanite's tool shed. Only the green paint was flaked and fading, and the windowless door in the center of it stood ajar. The door was flanked by warning signs. The plastic that encased them had bleared over time, but they were still readable. "Absolutely no trespassing" on the left, and "This property condemned by order of Marysville Town Council" on the right. Ralph went to the door, Glock ready. He motioned Holly to stand against the path's rocky side, then swung the door open, bending at the knees and bringing his gun to bear as he did so. Inside was a small entryway, empty except for the litter of boards that had been torn away from a 6-foot fissure leading into darkness. The splintered ends were still attached to the rock by more of those huge time-rusted bolts.
"Ralph, look at this. It's interesting."
She was holding the door and bending to examine the lock, which had been pretty well destroyed. It didn't look like the work of a crowbar or tire iron to Ralph. He thought someone had hammered it with a rock until it finally gave. "What, Holly?"
"It's a one-way. Do you see? Only locked if you're on the outside. Somebody was hoping the Jameson twins or some of the first rescue party were still alive. If they found their way here, they wanted to make sure they weren't locked in.
But no one ever did.
No. She crossed the entryway to the fissure in the rock. Can you smell that?
Ralph could, and knew they were standing at the entrance to a different world. He could smell stale dampness and something else. The high, sweet aroma of rotting flesh. It was faint, but it was there. He thought of that long-ago cantaloupe and the insects that had been squirming around inside it. They stepped into the dark. Ralph was tall, but the fissure was taller, and he didn't have to duck his head. Holly turned on the flashlight, at first shining it straight ahead into a rocky corridor leading downward, then at their feet. They both saw a series of glowing droplets leading into the dark. Holly did him the courtesy of not pointing out that it was the same stuff her makeshift black light had picked up in his living room. They were only able to walk side by side for the first 60 feet or so. After that, the passage narrowed, and Holly handed him the flashlight. He held it in his left hand, the pistol in his right. The walls sparkled with eerie streaks of mineral, some red, some lavender, some a greenish yellow. He occasionally shone the light upward just to make sure El Cuco wasn't up there, crawling along the ragged ceiling among the stubs of stalactites. The air wasn't cold. He had read somewhere that caves maintained a temperature roughly equal to the average temperature of the region in which they were located. But it felt cold after being outside, and of course both of them were still coated in fear sweat. A draft was coming from deeper in, blowing in their faces and bringing that faint, rotten smell. He stopped, and Holly ran into him, making him jump.
What?
She whispered. Instead of answering, he shone the light on a rift in the rock to their left. Spray painted beside it were two words, checked and nothing.
They moved on, slowly, slowly. Ralph didn't know about Holly, but he felt an increasing sense of dread, a growing certainty that he was never going to see his wife and son again, or daylight. It was amazing how fast a person could miss the daylight. He felt that if they did get out of here, he would drink daylight like water. Holly whispered, "This is a horrible place, isn't it?"
"Yes. You should go back." Her only answer was a slight push in the center of his back. They passed several more breaks in the downward passage, each one marked with those same two words. How long ago had they been sprayed there? If Claude Bolton had been a teenager, it had to be at least 15 years, maybe 20. And who had been in here since then, other than their outsider, that was? Anyone? Why would they come? Holly was right. It was horrible. With each step, he felt more like a man being buried alive. He forced himself to remember the clearing in Figgis Park and Frank Peterson and a jutting branch marked with bloody fingerprints where the bark had been stripped from it by repeated plunging blows. And Terry Maitland asking how Ralph was going to clear his own conscience. Asking that as he lay dying. He kept going. The passage abruptly narrowed even further, not because the walls were closer, but because there was rubble on both sides. Ralph shone the flashlight upward and saw a deep cavity in the rock roof. It made him think of an empty socket after a tooth has been pulled. "Holly, this is where the roof caved in. The second rescue party probably carted the biggest pieces out. This stuff." He swept the light across the heaps of rubble, picking out another couple of those spectrally glowing spots.
"This is the stuff they didn't bother with," Holly finished. "Just pushed it out of the way."
"Yes." They started moving again,
at first only edging along. Ralph, something of a wide body, had to turn sideways. He handed Holly the flashlight and raised his gun hand to the side of his face. "Shine the light under my arm. Keep it pointed straight ahead. No surprises."
"Oh, okay."
"You sound cold."
"I am cold. You should be quiet. He could hear us."
"So what? He knows we're coming. You do think a bullet will kill him, right? You..."
"Stop, Ralph, stop! You step in it!"
He stopped at once, heart hammering. She shone the light a bit past his feet. Draped over the last pile of rubble before the passage widened again was the body of a dog or a coyote. A coyote seemed more likely, but it was impossible to tell for sure because the animal's head was gone. Its belly had been opened, and the viscera had been scooped out.
"That's what we were smelling," she said.
Ralph stepped over it carefully. 10 feet further on, he halted again. It had been a coyote, all right. Here was the head. It seemed to be staring at them with exaggerated surprise, and at first he couldn't understand just why. Holly was a little quicker on the uptake.
"Its eyes are gone," she said. "Eating the insides wasn't enough. It ate the eyes right out of that poor creature's head."
"Oof."
"So the outsider doesn't just eat human flesh and blood," he paused. "Or sadness."
Holly spoke quietly. "Thanks to us, mostly thanks to you and Lieutenant Saplo, it's been very active in what's usually its time of hibernation. And it's been denied the food it likes. It must be very hungry."
"And weak. You said it must be weak."
"Let us hope so," Holly said. "This is extremely frightening. I hate closed-in places."
"You can always..." She gave him another of those light thumps.
"Keep going, and watch your step."
20. The trail of faintly luminous droplets continued. Ralph had come to think of them as the thing's sweat. Fear sweat like theirs? He hoped so. He hoped the fucker had been terrified and still was. There were more fissures, but no more spray paint. These were little more than cracks, too small even for a child to fit into, or escape from. Holly was able to walk beside him again, although it was a tight fit. They could hear water dripping somewhere far away. Once Ralph felt a new breeze, this one against his left cheek. It was like being caressed with ghost fingers. It was coming from one of those cracks, producing a hollow, almost glassy moan, like the sound of breath blown over the top of a beer bottle. A horrible place, all right. He found it all but impossible to believe people had paid money to explore this stone crypt, but of course they didn't know what he knew and now believed. It was sort of amazing how being in the guts of the ground helped a person to believe what had previously seemed not just impossible, but downright laughable.
"Careful," Holly said. "There's more." This time, it was a couple of gophers that had been torn to pieces. Beyond them was the remains of another rattler, all of it gone except for tatters of its diamondback skin. A little further on, they came to the top of a steep downward slope, its surface polished as smooth as a dance floor. Ralph thought it had probably been created by some ancient underground river that had flowed during the age of the dinosaurs and dried up before Jesus walked the earth. To one side was a steel railing, now spotted with florets of rust. Holly ran the light along it, and they saw not just scattered droplets of luminescence, but palm prints and fingerprints. Prints that would match Claude Bolton's, Ralph had no doubt. Son of a bitch was careful, wasn't he?
didn't want to take a spill. Holly nodded.
I think this is the passageway Lovey called the Devil's Slide. Watch your step.
From somewhere behind and below them came a brief squall of rock, followed by a barely perceptible thud that went through their feet. It reminded Ralph of how even solid ice could sometimes shift. Holly looked at him, wide-eyed. I think we're okay. This old cave's been talking to itself for a long time.
Yes, but I bet the conversation's been livelier since the ground shaker Lovey told us about. The one that happened in 07.
You can always... Don't ask me again. I have to see this through. He supposed she did. They went down the incline, holding the railing but being careful to avoid the handprints left by the one who had gone before them. At the bottom, there was a sign, "Welcome to the Devil's Slide. Be safe. Use handrail." Beyond the slide, the passage widened still more. There was another of those arched entryways, but part of the wooden facing had fallen away, disclosing what nature had left here. Nothing but a ragged maw.
Holly cupped her hands around her mouth and called softly, "Hello?" Her voice came back to them perfectly in a series of overlapping echoes. "Hello? Hello? Hello?" "I thought so," she said. "It's the chamber of sound. It's the big one that Lovey..."
"Hello? Hello? Low? Low?" Spoken quietly, but stopping Ralph in the middle of drawing a breath. He felt Holly seize his forearm with a hand that felt like a claw. "Now that you're here, you're here, and gone to so much trouble to find me, why don't you come in?" 21. They stepped through the arch, side by side, Holly holding on to Ralph's arm like a bride with stage fright. She had the light. Ralph had his Glock and intended to use it as soon as he had a target. One shot. Only there was no target. Not at first. Beyond the arch was a jutting lip of stone that made a sort of balcony 70 feet above the main cave's floor. A metal stairway spiraled down. Holly glanced up and felt dizzy. The stairs rose another 200 feet or more, past an opening that had probably been the main entrance, all the way to the stalactite-hung roof. She realized the entire bluff was hollow, like a fake bakery shop cake. Going down, the stairway looked okay. Above them, part of it had come loose from the fist-sized bolts that held it and hung drunkenly over the drop. Waiting for them at the bottom, in the light of an ordinary standing lamp, the kind you might see in any reasonably well-appointed living room, was the outsider. The lamp's cord snaked away to a softly humming red box with "Honda" printed on the side. At the extreme outer edge of the circle of radiance was a cot with a blanket bunched at the bottom. Ralph had caught up with many fugitives in his time, and the thing they had come looking for could have been any of them, hollow-eyed, too thin, used hard. He was wearing jeans, a rawhide vest over a dirty white shirt, and scuffed cowboy boots. He appeared unarmed. He was looking up at them with Claude Bolton's face, the black hair, the high cheekbones suggesting some Native American blood a few generations back, the goatee. Ralph couldn't see the ink on his fingers from where he was, but he knew it was there. "Tat Man," Hoskins had called him.
"If you really mean to talk to me, you'll have to chance the stairs. They held me, but I have to tell you the truth. They're not all that steady."
His words, although spoken in a conversational voice, overlapped each other, doubling and tripling
as if there were not just one outsider, but many, a cabal of them, hiding in the shadows and the fissures where the light of that single floor lamp could not reach. Holly started for the stairs. Ralph stopped her.
I'll go first.
I should. I'm lighter.
I'll go first, he repeated. When I get down, if I get down, you come.
He spoke quietly, but guessed that, given the acoustics, the outsider could hear every word. At least I hope so, Ralph thought. But stop at least a dozen steps up. I have to talk to him. He was looking at her as he said this, and looking hard. She glanced at the Glock, and he gave the barest nod. No, there would be no talking. No long-winded Q&A. All that was over. One shot to the head, and then they were out of here. Assuming the roof didn't fall in on them, that was. All right, she said. Be careful. There was no way to do that. Either the old spiral staircase would hold or it wouldn't, but he tried to think himself lighter as he went down. The stairs groaned and squalled and shuddered.
Doing well so far, the outsider said. Walk close to the wall, that might be safest, safest, best.
Ralph reached the bottom. The outsider stood motionless near his strangely domestic lamp. Had he bought it, and the generator and the cot, at the Home Depot in Tippett? Ralph thought it likely. It seemed to be the go-to place in this godforsaken part of the Lone Star State. Not that it mattered. Behind him, the stairs began to squall and groan again as Holly descended. Now that Ralph was on the same level, he stared at the outsider with what was almost scientific curiosity. He looked human, but was oddly hard to grasp, even so. It was like looking at a picture with your eyes slightly crossed. You knew what it was you were seeing, but everything was skewed and slightly out of true. It was Claude Bolton's face, but the chin was wrong. Not rounded, but square, and slightly cleft. The jawline on the right was longer than the one on the left, giving the face as a whole a slanted aspect that stopped just short of grotesque. The hair was Claude's, as black and shiny as a crow's wing, but there were streaks of a lighter, reddish-brown shade. Most striking of all were the eyes. One was brown, as Claude's were brown, but the other was blue. Ralph knew the cleft chin, the long jaw, the reddish-brown hair, and the blue eye, that most of all. He had seen the light go out of it, as Terry Maitland died in the street on a hot July morning not long ago.
You're still changing, aren't you? The projection my wife saw may have looked exactly like Claude, but the real you hasn't caught up yet, has it? You're not quite there.
He meant these to be the last words the outsider would hear. The protesting groans from the stairs had stopped, which meant Holly was standing high up enough to be safe. He raised the Glock, gripping his right wrist in his left hand. The outsider lifted his arms to either side, presenting himself.
Kill me if you want, detective, but you'll be killing yourself and your lady friend, too. I don't have access to your thoughts, as I do Claude's, but I have a good idea of what's in your mind, just the same. You're thinking that one shot is an acceptable risk. Am I right?
Ralph said nothing. I'm sure I am. And I must tell you, it would be a great risk. He raised his voice and shouted, Claude Bolton is my name. The echoes seemed even louder than the shout. Holly gave a cry of surprise as a piece of stalactite high above, perhaps cracked almost through already, detached from the ceiling and fell like a rock dagger. It posed no danger to any of them, hitting bottom well outside the feeble circle of lamplight, but Ralph took the point.
Since you knew enough to find me here, you may already know this, the outsider said, lowering his arms. But in case you don't, two boys were lost in the caves and passages below this one, and when a rescue party tried to find them,
someone fired a gun and brought down a piece of the roof, Holly said from the stairs. Yes, we know.
That happened in the Devil's Slide passage, where the sound of the gunshot would have been dampened,
smiling.
Who knows what will happen if Detective Anderson fires his gun in here? Surely a few of the bigger stalactites will come raining down.
Even so, you might avoid them.
Of course, if you don't, you'll be crushed. Then there's the possibility you might cause the entire top of the bluff to collapse, burying us all in a landslide. Want to risk it, Detective? I'm sure you meant to when you came down the stairs, but I have to tell you, the odds would not be in your favor.
Those stairs creaked briefly as Holly came down. Another step, maybe two. Keep your distance, Ralph thought, but there was no way he could make her do that. This lady had a mind of her own.
We also know why you're here, she said. Claude's uncle and cousins are here, in the crowd.
Indeed they are. It was smiling more widely now. The gold tooth in that smile was Claude's, like the letters on his fingers.
Along with many others, including the two children, they hope to save. I feel them in the earth. Some are close. Roger Bolton and his sons are over there, not 20 feet below Snake's Belly. He pointed.
I feel them the most strongly, not because they're close, but because they are the blood I'm becoming.
Not good to eat, though, I guess, Ralph said. He was looking at the cot. Barely visible on the stone floor beside it, next to a styrofoam cooler, was another untidy litter of bones and skin.
No, of course not.
The outsider looked at him impatiently.
But their remains give off a glow. A kind of, I don't know. These are not things I ordinarily talk about. A kind of emanation. Even those foolish boys give off that glow, although it's faint. They're very far down. You might say they died exploring uncharted regions of the Marysville Hole.
At this, his smile reappeared, showing not just the gold tooth, but almost all of them. Ralph wondered if he had been smiling like that as he murdered Frank Peterson, eating his flesh and drinking the child's dying agony along with his blood.
A glow like a nightlight? Holly asked. She sounded genuinely curious.
The stairs squalled as she descended another step or two. Ralph wished mightily that she was going the other way, up and out, back into the hot Texas sunshine. The outsider only shrugged. Go back, he thought at Holly. Turn around and go back. When I'm sure you've had time enough to make it out the Ahiga back door, I'll take the shot. Even if it makes my wife a widow and my son fatherless, I'll take the shot. I owe it to Terry and all the others who came before him.
A nightlight, she repeated, coming down another step. You know, for comfort. I had one when I was a girl.
The outsider was looking up at her over Ralph's shoulder, with his back to the standing lamp and his face in the shadows. Ralph could see a strange shine in those mismatched eyes. Except that wasn't quite right. It wasn't in them, but coming from them. And now Ralph understood what Grace Maitland had meant when she said the things she'd seen had straws for eyes.
Comfort. The outsider seemed to consider the word. Yes, I suppose so, although I've never thought of it that way. But also information. Even dead, they're full of boltonness.
Do you mean memories? Another step closer. Ralph took his left hand off his wrist and motioned her back, knowing she wouldn't go.
No, not those. He looked impatient with her again, but there was something else there, too. A certain eagerness, Ralph knew from many interrogation rooms. Not every suspect wanted to talk, but most of them did because they had been alone in the closed room of their thoughts. And this thing must have been alone with its thoughts for a very long time. Alone, period. You only had to look at him to know it.
Then, what is it?
She was still in the same place. And thank God for small blessings, Ralph thought. Bloodline. There's something in bloodline that goes beyond memory or the physical similarities that are carried down through the generations. It's a way of being, a way of seeing. It's not food, but it is strength. Their souls are gone, their ka, but something is left. Even in their dead brains and bodies.
A kind of DNA, she said. Maybe tribal, maybe racial.
I suppose, if you like. He took a step toward Ralph, holding out the hand with must written on the fingers. It's like these tattoos. They aren't alive, but they hold certain info.
Stop! She shouted, and Ralph thought, Christ, she's even closer. How could she do that without me hearing?
The echoes rose, seeming to expand, and something else fell. Not a stalactite this time, but a chunk of rock from one of the rough walls.
Don't do that, the outsider said.
Unless you want to risk bringing the whole thing down on our heads, don't raise your voice like that.
When Holly spoke again, her voice was lower, but still urgent. Remember what he did to Detective Hoskins, Ralph. His touch is poisonous.
Only when I'm in this transformative state, the outsider said mildly. It's a form of natural protection and rarely fatal. More like poison ivy than some sort of radiation.
Of course, Detective Hoskins was
susceptible, shall we say? And once I've touched someone, I can often, not always, but often, get into their minds, or the minds of their loved ones. I did that with Frank Peterson's family. Only a little, enough to push them in directions they were already going.
You should stay where you are, Ralph said. The outsider raised his tattooed hands.
Certainly. As I've said, you're the man with the gun. But I can't let you leave. I'm too tired to relocate, you see. I had to make the drive down here far too soon, and I had to buy a few supplies, which drained me even more. It seems we're at a standoff.
You put yourself in this position, Ralph said. I mean, you know that, right?
The outsider looked at him out of a face that still held the fading remains of Terry Maitland, and said nothing.
Heath Holmes, okay. The others before Holmes, also okay. But Maitland was a mistake.
I suppose that's so. The outsider looked puzzled, but still complacent. Yet, I've taken others who had strong alibis and immaculate reputations. With evidence and eyewitness testimony, the alibis and reputations make no difference. People are blind to explanations that lie outside their perception of reality. You should never have come looking for me. You never should have even sensed me. No matter how strong his alibi was.
Yet, you did.
Was it because I came to the courthouse?
Ralph said nothing.
Holly had come down the last step and was now standing beside him. The outsider sighed.
That was a mistake. I should have thought more seriously about the presence of TV cameras. But I was still hungry. Yet I could have stayed away. I was gluttonous.
Add overconfident while you're at it, Ralph said, and overconfidence breeds carelessness. Cops see a lot of that.
Well, perhaps I was all three, but I think I might have gotten away even with that.
He was looking speculatively at the pale gray-haired woman next to Ralph.
It's you I have to thank for being in this current situation, isn't it? Holly. Claude says your name is Holly.
What made you able to believe? How were you able to convince a party of modern men who probably don't believe in anything beyond the range of their five senses to come down here? Have you seen another one like me somewhere?
The eagerness in his voice was unmistakable.
We didn't come here to answer your questions, Holly said. One of her hands was stuffed into the pocket of her wrinkled suit jacket. In the other she held the UV flashlight, which was not turned on at the moment. The only light came from the standing lamp. We came here to kill you.
I'm not sure how you hope to do that, Holly. Your friend might chance firing his gun if it was just the two of us, but I don't think he wants to risk your life as well. And while one or both of you might try to attack me physically, I think you'd find me surprisingly strong, as well as a bit poisonous. Yes, even in my current, depleted state.
It's a standoff for now, Ralph said, but not for long. Hoskins wounded State Police Lieutenant Unell Sablo, but didn't kill him. By now he will have called this in.
A good try, but not out here, the outsider said. There's no cell reception for 6 miles going east and a dozen going west. Did you think I wouldn't check?
Ralph had been hoping for just that, but it had been a thin hope. As it happened, however, he had another card in his hand. Hoskins also blew up the vehicle we came in. There's smoke. Plenty of it. For the first time, he saw real alarm in the outsider's face.
That changes things. I'll have to run. In my current state, that will be difficult and painful. If you wanted to make me angry, detective, you succeed.
You asked me if I had seen one of your kind before, Holly interrupted. I haven't. Well, not exactly. But I'm sure Ralph has. Strip away the shape-changing, the memory-sucking, and the glowing eyes, and you're just a sexual sadist and common pedophile.
The outsider recoiled as if she had struck him. For a moment he seemed to forget all about the burning SUV sending up smoke signals from the abandoned parking lot.
That's offensive, ridiculous, and untrue. I eat to live, that's all.
Your kind does the same thing when you slaughter pigs and cows. That's all you are to me. Cattle.
You're lying.
Holly took a step forward, and when Ralph tried to take her by the arm, she shook him off. Red roses had begun to bloom in her pale cheeks.
Your ability to look like someone you're not, something you're not, guarantees trust. You could have taken any of Mr. Maitland's friends. You could have taken his wife. But instead of that, you took a child. You always take children.
They are the strongest, sweetest food. Have you never eaten veal or calf's liver?
You don't just eat them, you ejaculate on them. Her mouth twisted in disgust. You splooge on them.
Oof. To leave DNA,
he shouted. You could leave it other ways, she shouted back, and something else fell from the eggshell ceiling above them. But you don't put your thing in, do you? Is it because you're impotent? She raised a finger, then let it curl. Is it? Is it?
Is it?
Shut up!
You take children because you're a child rapist who can't even do it with his penis. You have to use a...
He ran at her, his face twisting into an expression of hate that had nothing of Claude Bolton or Terry Maitland in it. This was its own thing, as black and awful as the lower depths where the Jameson twins had finally surrendered their lives. Ralph raised his gun, but Holly stepped into his line of fire before he could get off a round.
Don't shoot, Ralph! Don't shoot!
Something else fell, this time something big, smashing the outsider's cot and cooler and sending shards of mineral sparkling stones spinning across the polished floor. Holly pulled something from a pocket of her suit coat on the side that always sagged. The thing was long and white and stretched, as if it contained something heavy. At the same time, she turned on the UV flashlight and shined it full in the outsider's face. He winced, made a snarling sound, and turned his head, still reaching for her with Claude Bolton's tattooed hands. She drew the white thing cross-body above her small breasts, all the way to her shoulder, and swung it with all her strength. The loaded end connected with the outsider's head, just below the hairline, at the temple. What Ralph saw then would haunt his dreams for years to come. The left half of the outsider's head caved in as if it had been made of papier-mâché rather than bone. The brown eye jumped in its socket. The thing went to its knees, and its face seemed to liquefy. Ralph saw 100 features slide across it in mere seconds, there and gone. High foreheads followed by low ones, bushy eyebrows, and one so blonde they were hardly there. Deep-set eyes, and ones that bulged, lips both wide and thin. Buck teeth protruded, then disappeared. Chins jutted and sank. Yet the last face, the one that lingered longest, almost certainly the outsider's true face, was utterly nondescript. It was the face of anyone you might pass on the street, seen at one moment and forgotten the next. Holly swung again, striking the cheekbone this time and driving the forgettable face into a hideous crescent. It looked like something out of an insane children's book. In the end, it's nothing, Ralph thought. Nobody. What looked like Claude, what looked like Terry, what looked like Heath Holmes. Nothing. Only false fronts. Only stage dressing. Reddish, worm-like things began to pour from the hole in the outsider's head, from its nose, from the cramped teardrop which was all that remained of its unsteady mouth. The worms fell to the stone floor of the chamber of sound in a squirming flood. Claude Bolton's body first began to tremble, then to buck, then to shrivel inside its clothes. Holly dropped the flashlight and raised the white thing over her head. It was a sock, Ralph saw, a man's long white athletic sock, now holding it in both hands. She brought it down one final time, crashing it into the top of the thing's head. Its face split down the middle like a rotted gourd. There was no brain in the cavity thus revealed, only a writhing nest of those worms, inescapably reminding Ralph of the maggots he had discovered in that long-ago cantaloupe. Those already released were squirming across the floor toward Holly's feet. She backed away from them, ran into Ralph, then buckled at the knees. He grabbed her and held her up. All the color had left her face. Tears spilled down her cheeks. "Drop the sock," he said in her ear. She looked at him dazed. "Some of those things are on it." When she still did nothing but look at him with a kind of dazed wonder, Ralph attempted to pull it from her fist. At first he couldn't. She had it in a death grip. He pried at her fingers, hoping he wouldn't have to break them to make her let go. But he would if he had to, if that was what it took. Those things would be a lot worse than poison ivy if they touched her and if they got under her skin. She seemed to come back to herself, a little anyway, and opened her hand. The sock dropped, the toe making a clunking sound when it hit the stone floor. He backed away from the worms, which were still blindly seeking, or maybe not blind at all. They were coming right for the two of them, pulling Holly by the hand, which was still curled from the fierce grip she'd had on the sock. She looked down, saw the danger, and drew in a breath. "Don't scream," he told her. "Can't risk anything else falling down. Just climb." He began to pull her up the stairs. After the first four or five, she was able to climb on her own, but they were going backward in order to keep an eye on the worms, which were still spilling from the outsider's cloven head, also from the teardrop mouth. "Stop," she whispered. "Stop. Look at them. They're just milling around. They can't get up the steps, and they're starting to die." She was right. They were slowing down, and a great heap of them near the outsider wasn't moving at all. But the body was. Somewhere inside it, the animating force was still trying to live. The Bolton thing humped and jerked, arms waving in a kind of semaphore. As they watched, the neck shortened. The remains of the head began to draw into the collar of the shirt. Claude Bolton's black hair at first stuck up, then was gone. "What is it?" Holly whispered. "What are they?"
"I don't know, and I don't care," Ralph said. "I only know that you'll never have to buy a drink for the rest of your life, at least when you're with me."
"I rarely drink alcohol," she said. "It goes badly with my medicine. I think I told you that."
She abruptly leaned over the rail and vomited. He held her while she did it.
"I'm sorry," she said.
"Don't be. Let's
get the frack out of here," she finished for him.
22. Sunlight had never felt so good. They got as far as the Chief Ahiga sign before Holly said she felt lightheaded and had to sit down. Ralph found a flat rock that was big enough for both of them and sat beside her. She glanced at the sprawled body of Jack Hoskins, made a desolate squeaking sound, and began to cry. At first it came out in a series of choked, reluctant sobs, as if someone had told her it was terribly wrong to weep in front of another person. Ralph put an arm around her shoulders, which felt sadly thin. She buried her face against the front of his shirt and began to sob in earnest. They had to get back to Yoon, who might have been more badly hurt than it had seemed. They had been under fire, after all, hardly the time to make an accurate diagnosis. Even at best, the man had a broken elbow and a dislocated shoulder. But she needed at least a little time, and she had earned it by doing what he, the big detective, had been unable to do. Within 45 seconds, the storm had begun to lessen. In a minute, it was over. She was good. Strong. Holly looked up at him, eyes red and swimming, but Ralph wasn't entirely sure she knew at first where she was, or who he was, for that matter.
"I can't do it again, Bill. Not ever. Ever, ever, ever. And if this one comes back the way Brady did, I'll kill myself. Do you hear me?"
He shook her gently. "He's not coming back, Holly. I promise you." She blinked.
"Ralph. I meant to say Ralph. Did you see what came out of his... Did you see those worms?"
"Yes."
"Ugh. Ugh."
She made a retching noise and covered her mouth. "Who told you how to make a blackjack out of a sock? And how hard it can hit if the sock is one of the long ones? Was it Bill Hodges?" Holly nodded. "What was it loaded with?"
"Ball bearings, just like Bill's. I bought them in the Walmart automotive department back in Flint City, because I can't use guns. I didn't think I'd have to use the happy slapper either. It was only an impulse."
"Or an intuition." He smiled, although he was hardly aware of it. He still felt numb all over, and kept looking around to make sure none of those worms were squirming after them, desperate to survive in a new host. Is that what you call it, the happy slapper?
It's what Bill called it. Ralph, we have to go.
Yoon, I know, but I have to do something first. Sit where you are. He went to Hoskins' body and made himself hunt through the dead man's pockets. He found the keys to the pickup truck and returned to Holly. Okay. They started down the path. Holly stumbled once and he grabbed her. Then it was his turn to almost go down, and it was she grabbing him. Like a couple of damn cripples, he thought. But after what we saw...
There's so much we don't know, she said. Where he came from. If those bugs were a disease, or maybe even some kind of alien life form. Who his victims were. Not just the children he killed, but the ones who got blamed for the killings. There must have been a lot of them. A lot. Did you see his face at the end? How it changed.
Yes, Ralph said. He would never forget it.
We don't know how long he lived, how he could project himself, what he was.
That much we do know, Ralph said. It was El Cuco. Oh, and something else. The son of a bitch is dead. 23. They were most of the way down the path when a horn began to beep in short blasts. Holly stopped, biting at lips which had already taken a lot of abuse. Relax, Ralph said. I think that's Yoon. The path was wider now and less steep, so they were able to move faster. When they came around the storage shed, they saw it was indeed Yoon, sitting half in and half out of Hoskins' pickup, beeping the horn with his right hand. His swollen and bloody left arm lay in his lap like a log. "You can quit that now," Ralph said. "Mother and father are here. How are you?"
"My arm hurts like blue fuck, but otherwise I'm okay. Did you get him? El Cuco?"
"We got him," Ralph said. "Holly got him. He wasn't human, but he died just the same. His days of killing children are over."
"Holly got him."
He looked at her.
"How?"
"We can talk about that later," she said. "Right now, I'm more concerned about you. Have you passed out? Are you lightheaded?"
"I got a little dizzy walking over here. Seemed to take forever, and I had to rest a couple of times. I was hoping I'd meet you coming out, praying more like it. Then I saw this truck. Must belong to the shooter. John P. Hoskins, according to the registration. Is he who I think he is?"
Ralph nodded. "Of the Flint City Police. And it's was. He's dead, too. I shot him."
Yoon's eyes widened. What the hell was he doing here?
"The outsider sent him. How he managed that, I have no idea.
I thought he might have left the keys, but no joy on that. And nothing for pain relief in the glove compartment either. Just the registration, his insurance card, and a bunch of crap."
"I've got the keys," Ralph said. "They were in his pocket."
"And I've got something for pain," Holly said. She reached into one of the voluminous side pockets of her beat-up suit coat and brought out a large brown prescription bottle. It was unlabeled.
"What else have you got in there?" Ralph asked. "A camp stove? Coffee pot? Shortwave radio?"
"Work on that sense of humor, Ralph."
"That's not me being funny. That's true admiration."
"I concur, most heartily," Yoon said.
She opened her traveling pharmacy, dumped an assortment of pills into her palm, and put the bottle carefully down on the truck's dashboard. "These are Zoloft, Paxil, Valium, which I rarely take anymore. And these." She carefully slid the rest of the pills back into the bottle, saving out two orange ones. "Motrin. I take it for tension headaches. Also for T TMJ pain, although that's better since I started using a night guard. I have the hybrid model. It's expensive, but it's the best one on the... She saw them looking at her. What?
Yoon said, just more admiration, Carita. I love a woman who comes prepared for all eventualities.
He took the pills, swallowed them dry, and closed his eyes.
Thank you so much. May your night guard never fail you.
She looked at him doubtfully as she stored the bottle back in her pocket.
I have two more when you need them. Have you heard any fire sirens?
No, Yoon said. I'm starting to think they're not coming.
They will, Ralph said, but you won't be here when they arrive. You need to go to the hospital. Plainville's a little closer than Tippett, plus the Bolton place is on the way. You'll need to stop there. Holly, will you be okay driving if I stay here?
Yes, but why?
Then she hit her forehead lightly with the palm of her hand.
Mr. Gold and Mr. Pelly.
Yes, I have no intention of leaving them where they fell.
Messing up a crime scene is generally frowned on, Yoon said, as I think you know.
I do, but won't allow two good men to cook in the hot sun and next to a burning vehicle.
Do you have a problem with that?
Yoon shook his head. Droplets of sweat shone in the bristles of his marine-style haircut.
Por supuesto, no.
I'll drive us around to the parking lot and then Holly can take over.
Are you getting any relief from that Motrin, amigo?
I am, actually. It ain't great, but it's better.
Good, because before we get rolling, we have to talk.
About?
About how we're going to explain this, Holly said. 24.
Once they were in the parking lot, Ralph got out. He met Holly coming around the hood of the truck, and this time it was she who hugged him. It was brief, but strong. The rental SUV had mostly burned itself out, and the smoke was thinning. Yoon moved, carefully, with several winces and hisses of pain, into the passenger seat. When Ralph leaned in, he said,
"You're sure he's dead?"
Ralph knew it wasn't Hoskins he was asking about.
You're sure?
Yes. He didn't exactly melt like the Wicked Witch of the West, but close. When the shit hits the fan out here, they're going to find nothing but his clothes and maybe a bunch of dead worms.
Worms? Yoon frowned.
Based on how fast they were dying, Holly said, I think the worms will decay very rapidly. But there will be DNA on the clothes, and if they should happen to run it against clods, they could get a match.
Or a mix of clods and Terry's, because his changeover wasn't complete. You saw that, right?
Holly nodded.
Which would make it worthless. I think Claude is going to be all right. Ralph took his cell phone from his pocket and put it in Yoon's good hand. You'll be okay to make the calls as soon as you start getting some bars?
Claro.
And you know the order of the calls? As Yoon ticked them off, they heard faint sirens coming from the direction of Tippett. Someone had noticed the smoke after all, it seemed, but the person who saw it hadn't bothered to come and investigate himself, which was probably good.
D.A. Bill Samuels. And then your wife. Chief Geller, after that. Finishing up with Captain Horace Kinney of the Texas Highway Patrol. All the numbers are in your contacts. The Boltons we talked to in person.
I'll talk to them, Holly said. You're going to sit still and rest your arm.
Very important Claude and Lovey get on board with the story, Ralph said. Now go on. If you're still here when the fire trucks arrive, you'll be stuck.
With the seat and the mirror adjusted to her satisfaction, Holly turned to Yoon and to Ralph, still leaning in the passenger door. She looked tired, but not exhausted. Her tears had passed. He saw nothing on her face but concentration and purpose. We need to keep this simple, she said, as simple and as close to the truth as we can get.
You've been through this before, Yoon said, or something like it, haven't you?
Yes, and they will believe us, even if they're left with questions that can never be answered. You both know why. Ralph, those sirens are getting closer, and we have to go.
Ralph closed the passenger door and watched them drive away in the dead Flint City detective's pickup. He considered the hard pan Holly would have to cross in order to avoid the chain, and thought she'd manage it just fine, skirting the worst of the holes and washes in order to spare Yoon's arm. Just when he thought he couldn't admire her more, he did. He went to Alec's body first, because it was the harder one to retrieve. The vehicle fire was almost out, but the heat radiating from it was fierce. Alec's face and arms had blackened. His head had been burned bald, and as Ralph grabbed him by the belt and began hauling him toward the gift shop, he tried not to think of the crispy bits and melted gobbets that were being left behind, and of how much Alec now looked like the man who had been at the courthouse that day. All he needs is a yellow shirt over his head, Ralph thought, and that was too much. He let go of the belt and managed to stagger 20 paces before bending over, grasping his knees and throwing up everything in his stomach. When that part was done, he went back and finished what he had started, dragging first Alec and then Howie Gold into the shade of the gift shop. He rested, getting his breath back, then examined the shop's door. It was padlocked, but the door itself looked weather-worn and flimsy. The second time he hit it, the hinges gave way. The interior was shadowy and explosively hot. The shelves were not entirely empty. A few souvenir T-shirts emblazoned with "I explored the Marysville hole" still remained. He took two and shook off the dust as best he could. Outside, the sirens were very close. Ralph thought they wouldn't want to drive their expensive equipment across the hard pan. They'd stop to cut the chain instead. He still had a little time. He knelt and covered the faces of the two men. Good men, who had fully expected to have years of life left in front of them. Men with families who would grieve. The only good thing, if there was anything good about it, was that their grief would not become a monster's meal. He sat beside them, forearms resting on his knees, chin on his chest. Was he responsible for these deaths, too? Partly, perhaps, because the chain always led back to that catastrophically unwise public arrest of Terry Maitland. But even in his exhaustion, he felt he did not need to own all of what had happened. "They will believe us," Holly had said, "and you both know why." Ralph did. They would believe even a shaky story, because footsteps didn't just end, and there was no way maggots could hatch inside a ripe cantaloupe with its tough skin intact. They would believe, because to admit any other possibility was to call reality itself into question. The irony was inescapable. The very thing that had protected the outsider during its long life of murder would now protect them. No end to the universe, Ralph thought, and waited in the shade of the gift shop for the fire trucks to arrive. 25. Holly drove to the Boltons, sitting upright, hands on the wheel at 10 and 2, listening as Yoon made the calls. Bill Samuels was horrified to learn that Howie Gold and Alec Pelly were dead, but Yoon cut off his questions. There would be time for questions and answers later, but that time was not now. Samuels was to re-interview all the witnesses who had been previously questioned, beginning with Willow Rainwater. He was to tell her straight out that serious questions had been raised about the identity of the man she had taken from the strip club to the train station in Dubrow. Was she still sure that person had been Terry Maitland? "Try to question her in a way that plants doubts," Yoon said. "Can you do that?"
"Sure," Samuel said. "I've been doing it in front of juries for the last 5 years, and based on her statement, Ms. Rainwater already has a few. So do the other witnesses, especially since that tape of Terry at the convention in Cap City went public. It's got 500,000 hits just on YouTube. Now tell me about Howie and Alec.
Later. Time is tight, Mr. Samuels. Talk to the wits, starting with Rainwater.
And something else. The meeting we had two nights ago. This is muy importante, so listen up.
Samuels listened. Samuels agreed, and Yoon moved on to Jeannie Anderson. That call was longer, because she both needed and deserved a fuller explanation. When he finished, there were tears, but perhaps mostly of relief. It was awful that men had died, that Yoon himself had been injured, but her man and her son's father was okay. Yoon told her what she needed to do, and Jeannie agreed to do it immediately. He was preparing to make the third call to FC Chief of Police Rodney Geller when they heard more sirens, this time approaching. Two Texas Highway Patrol cars blasted by them, headed for the Marysville hole.
If we're lucky, Yoon said, maybe one of those troops is the guy who talked to the Boltons. Stape, I think his name was.
Sipe, Holly corrected. Owen Sipe. How's your arm?
Still hurts like blue fuck. I'm going to take those other two Motrin.
No. Too much all at once can damage your liver. Make the other calls. But first, go to Recents and delete the ones you made to Mr. Samuels and Mrs. Anderson.
You would have made a hell of a crook, Senorita.
Just being careful. Prudente. She didn't look away from the road. It was empty, but she was that kind of driver. Do it, then make the rest of your calls.
26. It turned out that Lovey Bolton had some old Percocets for back pain. Yoon took two of them instead of the Motrin, and Claude, who had taken a first aid course during his third and last stretch in prison, bandaged his wound while Holly talked. She did so rapidly, and not just because she wanted to get Lieutenant Sablo some real care. She needed the Boltons to understand their part in this before anyone official showed up. That would be soon, because the officers from the Highway Patrol would have questions for Ralph, and he would have to answer them. At least there was no disbelief here. Lovey and Claude had felt the presence of the outsider two nights ago, and Claude had been feeling him even before that, a sense of disquiet, dislocation, and being watched. "Of course you felt him," Holly said grimly. "He was plundering your mind."
"You saw him," Claude said. "He was hiding in that cave, and you saw him."
"Yes."
"And he looked like me."
"Almost exactly." Lovey spoke up, sounding timid.
"Would I have known the difference?"
Holly smiled. "At a glance, I'm sure of it. Lieutenant Sablo, Yoon, are you ready to go?"
"Yes." He stood up. "One great thing about hard drugs. Everything still hurts, but you don't give a shit." Claude burst out laughing and pointed a finger gun at him. "You got that right, brother."
He saw Lovey frowning at him and added, "Sorry, Ma." "You understand the story you have to tell?" Holly asked.
"Yes, ma'am," Claude said. "Too simple to screw up. The Flint City DA is thinking of reopening the Maitland case, and you all came down here to question me."
"And you said what?" Holly asked.
"That the more I think about it, the more I'm sure it wasn't Coach Terry I saw that night, just someone who looked like him."
"What else?" Yoon asked. "Very important."
Lovey answered this time.
"The bunch of you stopped by this morning to say goodbye and to ask if there was anything we might have forgotten. While you were getting ready to leave, there was a phone call."
"On your landline," Holly added, thinking, "Thank God they still have one."
"That's right, on the landline. The man said he worked with Detective Anderson."
"Who spoke to him?" Holly said.
"That's right. The man told Detective Anderson the fella you all were looking for, the real killer, was hiding out in the Marysville hole.
Stick to that, Holly said. And thank you both.
We are the ones who should be thanking you, Lovey said, and held out her arms. You come here, Miss Holly Gibney, and give old Lovey a hug.
Holly went to the wheelchair and bent down. After the Marysville hole, Lovey Bolton's arms felt good, necessary even. She stayed in their embrace as long as she could. 27. Marcy Maitland had grown exceedingly wary of callers since her husband's public arrest, not to mention his public execution. So when the knock came at her door, she first went to the window, twitched aside the drapes, and peeped out. It was Detective Anderson's wife on the stoop, and it looked like she had been crying. Marcy hurried to the door and opened it. Yes, those were tears, and as soon as Jeannie saw Marcy's concerned face, they started again. What is it? What's happened? Are they all right? Jeannie stepped in. Where are your girls? Out back under the big tree, playing cribbage with Terry's board. They played all last night and started again early this morning. What's wrong? Jeannie took her by the arm and led her into the living room. You might want to sit down. Marcy stood where she was. Just tell me. There's good news, but there's also terrible news. Ralph and the Gibney woman are all right. Lieutenant Sablo was shot, but they don't believe it's life-threatening. Howie Gold and Mr. Pelly, though, they're dead. Shot from ambush by a man my husband works with. A detective. Jack Hoskins is his name. Dead? Dead? How can they be... Marcy sat heavily in what had been Terry's easy chair. It was either that or fall down. She stared up at Jeannie uncomprehendingly. What do you mean? Good news. How can there be... Jesus, it just keeps getting worse. She put her hands over her face. Jeannie dropped to her knees beside the chair and pulled them away, gently but firmly. You need to get yourself together, Marcy. I can't. My husband's dead, and now this? I don't think I'll ever be together again, not even for Grace and Sarah. Stop it. Jeannie's voice was low, but Marcy blinked as if she had been slapped. Nothing can bring Terry back, but two good men died to redeem his name and give your girls a chance in this town. They have families, too, and I'll have to talk to Elaine Gold after I leave here. That's going to be awful. Yoon has been hurt, and my husband risked his life. I know you're in pain, but this part is not about you. Ralph needs your help. So do the others. So pull yourself together and listen. All right. Yes. Jeannie lifted one of Marcy's hands and held it. The fingers were cold, and Jeannie supposed her own weren't much warmer. Everything Holly Gibney told us was true. There was an outsider, and he wasn't a man. He was something else. Call him El Cuco, call him Dracula, call him the son of Sam or of Satan, it doesn't matter. He was there, in a cave. They found him and killed him. Ralph told me he looked like Claude Bolton, although the real Claude Bolton was miles away. I talked to Bill Samuels before I came over here. He thinks that if we all tell the same story, everything will be okay. It's likely we can clear Terry's name if we all tell the same story. Can you do that? Jeannie could see hope filling Marcy Maitland's eyes, like water filling a well. Yes, yes, I can do that. But what is the story? The meeting we had was only about trying to clear Terry's name. Nothing else. Just about clearing his name.
At that meeting, Bill Samuels agreed to re-interview all the witnesses Ralph and the other officers questioned, starting with Willow Rainwater and working backward, right? Yes, that's right. The reason he couldn't start with Claude Bolton is that Mr. Bolton is in Texas helping out with his mother, who's not well. Howie suggested that he, Alec, Holly, and my husband should go down there and question Claude. Yoon said he would join them if possible. Do you remember that? Yes, Marcy said, nodding rapidly. We all thought that was an excellent idea, but I don't remember why Miss Gibney was at the meeting. She was the investigator Alec Pelly hired to check on Terry's movements in Ohio. She got interested in the case, so she came down to see if she could give further assistance. Remember now? Yes. Holding Marcy's hand, looking into Marcy's eyes, Jeannie gave her the last and most important part. We never discussed shape changers, or El Cucos, or ghostly projections, or anything that might be called supernatural. No, absolutely not. It never crossed our minds. Why would it? We thought that someone who looked like Terry killed the Peterson boy and tried to frame him for it. We called this person the Outsider. Yes, Marcy said, squeezing Jeannie's hand. That's what we called him. The Outsider.
Flint City. After. 1. The plane chartered by the late Howard Gold landed at the Flint City airport just after 11 o'clock in the morning. Neither Howie nor Alec was aboard. Once the medical examiner finished his work, the bodies had been transported back to FC in a hearse from the Plainville funeral home. Ralph, Yoon, and Holly shared the expense of that, as well as a second hearse, which transported the body of Jack Hoskins. Yoon spoke for all of them when he said there was no way the son of a bitch was going home with the men he had murdered. Waiting for them on the tarmac was Jeannie Anderson, standing next to Yoon's wife and two sons. The boys brushed past Jeannie, one of them, a husky preteen named Hector, almost knocked her off her feet, and bolted for their father, whose arm was in a cast and a sling. He embraced them with his good arm, as best he could, disengaged himself, and beckoned his wife. She came on the run. So did Jeannie, her skirt flying out behind her. She threw her arms around Ralph and hugged him fiercely. The Sablos and the Andersons stood in family embraces near the door to the little private terminal, hugging and laughing, until Ralph looked around and saw Holly standing alone by the wing of the King Air, watching them. She was wearing a new pantsuit, which she had been forced to buy at Plainville Ladies Apparel, the nearest Walmart being 40 miles away on the outskirts of Austin. Ralph beckoned her, and she came forward a little shyly. She stopped a few feet away, but Jeannie was having none of that. She reached for Holly's hand, pulled her close, and hugged her. Ralph put his arms around both of them. "Thank you," Jeannie whispered in Holly's ear. "Thank you for bringing him back to me." Holly said,
"We hoped to come home right after the inquest, but the doctors made Lieutenant Sablo Yoon wait another day. There was a blood clot in his arm, and the doctor wanted to dissolve it."
She disengaged herself from the embrace, flushed but looking pleased.
10 feet away, Gabriella Sablo was exhorting her boys to leave Papi alone, or they would break his arm all over again.
"What does Derek know about this?" Ralph asked his wife. "He knows that his dad was in a shootout down in Texas and that you're all right. He knows two other men died. He asked to come home early." "And you said?"
"I said, okay. He'll be here next week. Does that work for you?"
"Yes. It would be good to see his son again. Tanned, healthy, with a few new muscles from swimming and rowing and archery, and on the right side of the ground. That was the most important thing. "We're eating at the house tonight," Jeannie said to Holly, "and you'll stay with us again. No arguments now. The guest room is all made up." "That would be nice," Holly said and smiled. Her smile faded as she turned to Ralph. "It would be better if Mr. Gold and Mr. Pelly could sit down to dinner with us. It's very wrong that they should be dead. It just seems..."
"I know," Ralph said, and put an arm around her. "I know how it seems."
2. Ralph barbecued steaks on a grill that was, thanks to his administrative leave, spandy clean. There was also salad, corn on the cob, and apple pie a la mode for dessert.
"A very American meal, Signor,"
Ewan observed as his wife cut his steak for him.
"It was delicious," Holly said.
Bill Samuels patted his stomach.
"I may be ready to eat again by Labor Day, but I'm not sure."
"Stuff and nonsense," Jeannie said. She took a bottle of beer from the cooler beside the picnic table, pouring half into Samuel's glass and half into her own. "You're too thin. You need a wife to feed you up.
Maybe when I go into private practice, my ex will come around. There's going to be a demand for a good lawyer here in town now that Howie..."
He suddenly realized what he was saying and brushed at his cowlick, which, thanks to a fresh haircut, wasn't there.
"A good lawyer can always find work, is what I meant."
They were quiet for a moment. Then Ralph raised his beer bottle. "To absent friends." They drank to that. Holly said, in a voice almost too quiet to be heard,
"Sometimes life can be very poopy."
No one laughed. The oppressive July heat had let up. The worst of the bugs were gone, and the Anderson backyard was a pleasant place to be. Once the meal was finished, Yoon's two boys and Marcy Maitland's two girls drifted to the basketball hoop on the side of the garage and began playing horse.
"So," Marcy said, even though the kids were a good distance away and absorbed in their game, she lowered her voice. "The inquest. Did the story hold up?"
"It did," Ralph said. "Hoskins called the Bolton house and lured us to the Marysville hole. There he went on a shooting spree, killing Howie and Alec and wounding Yoon. I stated my belief that it was me he was really after. We've had our differences over the years, and the more he drank, the more that must have eaten into him. The assumption is that he was with some as yet unidentified accomplice who kept him supplied with booze and drugs. The medical examiner found traces of cocaine in his system and fed his paranoia. The Texas HP went into the chamber of sound, but did not find the accomplice."
"Just some clothes," Holly said.
"And you're sure he's dead?" Jeannie said.
"The outsider. You're sure?"
"Yes," Ralph said. "If you'd seen, you'd know."
"Be glad you didn't," Holly said. "Is it over?" Gabriella Sablo asked. "That's all I care about. Is it really over?"
"No," Marcy said. "Not for me and the girls. Not unless Terry's cleared. And how can he be? He was killed before he got his day in court."
Samuel said, "We're working on that."
August 1st. 3.
As the light of his first full day back in Flint City dawned, Ralph once more stood at his bedroom window, hands clasped behind his back, looking down at Holly Gibney, who was once more sitting in one of the backyard lawn chairs. He checked Jeannie, found her asleep and snoring softly, and went downstairs. He wasn't surprised to see Holly's bag in the kitchen, already packed with her few things for the flight north. As well as knowing her own mind, she was a lady who did not let the grass grow under her feet, and he supposed she would be very glad to get the hell out of Flint City.
On the previous early morning, when he had been out here with Holly, the smell of coffee had awakened Jeannie, so this time he brought orange juice. He loved his wife and valued her company, but he wanted this to be just between him and Holly. They shared a bond, and always would, even if they never saw each other again. "Thank you," she said. "There's nothing better than orange juice in the morning." She looked at the glass with satisfaction, then drank half of it. "Coffee can wait."
"What time is your flight?"
11:15. "I'll leave here by 8:00. She gave a slightly embarrassed smile at his look of surprise. "I know. I'm a compulsive early bird. The Zoloft helps with a lot of things, but it doesn't seem to help with that."
"Did you sleep?"
"A little." "Did you?"
"A little."
They were quiet for a time. The first bird sang, tender and sweet. Another responded.
"Bad dreams?" he asked.
"Yes." "You?"
"Yes."
"Those worms."
"I had bad dreams after Brady Hartsfield, too. Both times." She touched his hand very lightly, then drew her fingers back. "There were a lot at first, but fewer as time passed."
"Do you think they ever go away entirely?"
"No, and I'm not sure I'd want them to. Dreams are the way we touch the unseen world. That's what I believe. They are a special gift."
"Even the bad ones?"
"Even the bad ones."
"Will you stay in touch?"
She looked surprised. "Of course. I'll want to know how things turn out. I'm a very curious person. Sometimes that gets me in trouble."
"And sometimes it gets you out."
Holly smiled. "I like to think so." She drank the rest of her juice. "Mr. Samuels will help you with this, I think. He reminds me a little bit of Scrooge after he saw the three ghosts. Actually, you do too." That made him laugh.
"Bill's going to do everything he can for Marcy and her daughters. I'll help. We both have a lot to make up for."
She nodded. "Do what you can. Absolutely. But then, let the fracking thing go. If you can't let go of the past, the mistakes you've made will eat you alive." She turned to him and gave him one of her rare, dead-on looks. "I'm a woman who knows." The kitchen light went on. Jeannie was up. Soon the three of them would have coffee out here at the picnic table. But while it was just the two of them, he had something else to say, and it was important.
"Thank you, Holly. Thank you for coming, and thank you for believing. Thank you for making me believe. If not for you, he'd still be out there."
She smiled. It was the radiant one. "You're welcome, but I'll be very happy to go back to finding deadbeats and bail jumpers and lost pets."
From the doorway, Jeannie called, "Who wants coffee?"
"Both of us," Ralph called back.
"Coming right up. Save a place for me."
Holly spoke in a voice so low he had to lean forward to hear her. He was evil. Pure evil. "No argument there," Ralph said. "But there's something I keep thinking about. That scrap of paper you found in the van. The one from Tommy and Tuppence. We talked about explanations for why it ended up where it did. Do you remember?"
"Sure."
"They all seem unlikely to me. It never should have been there at all, but it was. And if not for that scrap, the link to what happened in Ohio, that thing might still be out there."
"Your point being?"
"It's simple," Holly said. "There's also a force for good in the world. That's something else I believe. Partly so I don't go crazy when I think of all the awful things that happen, I guess. But also, well, the evidence seems to bear it out, wouldn't you say? Not just here, but everywhere. There's some force that tries to restore the balance. When the bad dreams come, Ralph, try to remember that little scrap of paper. He didn't reply at first, and she asked what he was thinking about. The screen door slammed, Jeannie with coffee. Their time together alone was almost up.
I was thinking about the universe. There really is no end to it, is there?
And no explaining it.
That's right, she said. No point in even trying.
August 10th. 4.
Flint County District Attorney William Samuels strode to the podium in the courthouse conference room with a slim folder in one hand. He stood behind a cluster of microphones. TV lights came on. He touched the back of his head, no cowlick, and waited for the assembled reporters to quiet. Ralph was sitting in the front row. Samuels gave him a brief nod before commencing.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I have a brief statement to make in regard to the murder of Frank Peterson, and then I will take your questions. As many of you know, a videotape exists showing Terrence Maitland attending a conference in Cap City at the same time Frank Peterson was being abducted and subsequently murdered here in Flint City. There can be no doubt of this tape's authenticity, nor can we doubt the statements given by Mr. Maitland's colleagues who accompanied him to the conference and attest to his presence there. In the course of our investigation, we have also discovered Mr. Maitland's fingerprints at the Cap City Hotel where the conference was held, and have obtained ancillary testimony that proves those prints were made too close to the time of the Peterson boys' murder for Mr. Maitland to be considered a suspect.
There was a murmur from the reporters. One of them called,
"Then how do you explain Maitland's prints at the scene of the murder?"
Samuels gave the reporter his best prosecutorial frown.
"Hold your questions, please. I was just coming to that. After further forensic examination, we now feel that the fingerprints found in the van used to abduct the child and those found in Figgis Park were planted. This is uncommon, but far from impossible. Various techniques for planting bogus fingerprints can be found on the Internet, which is a valuable resource for criminals as well as law enforcement. It does suggest, however, that this murderer is crafty as well as perverted and extremely dangerous. It may or may not suggest that he had a grudge against Terry Maitland. That is a line of investigation we will continue to pursue."
He surveyed his audience soberly, feeling very glad indeed that he would never have to run for re-election in Flint County. After this, any shyster with a mail-order law degree could probably beat him, and handily.
"You would have a perfect right to ask why we proceeded with the case against Mr. Maitland, given the facts I have just reviewed for you. There were two reasons. The most obvious is that we did not have all these facts in hand on the day Mr. Maitland was arrested, or on the day he would have been arraigned."
"Ah, but by then we had most of them, didn't we, Bill?" Ralph thought as he sat dressed in his best suit and watching with his best law enforcement poker face.
"The second reason we proceeded," Samuels continued, "was the presence of DNA at the scene, which seemed to match that of Mr. Maitland. There is a popular assumption that DNA matching is never wrong, but as the Council for Responsible Genetics pointed out in a scholarly article titled The Potential for Error in Forensic DNA Testing, that is a misconception. If samples are mixed, for instance, the matching can't be trusted, and the samples taken at the Figgis Park scene were indeed mixed, containing DNA from both perpetrator and victim."
He waited until the reporters had finished scribbling before going on.
"Added to this, the samples were exposed to ultraviolet light during the course of another unrelated testing procedure. Unfortunately, they are degraded to a point where they would have been, in the opinion of my department, inadmissible in a court of law. In plain English, the samples are worthless."
He paused, turning to the next sheet in his folder. This was mere stagecraft, as all of the sheets in it were blank.
"I only want to touch briefly on the events that took place in Marysville, Texas, subsequent to the murder of Terrence Maitland. It is our opinion that Detective John Hoskins of the Flint City Police Department was in some sort of twisted and criminal partnership with the person who killed Frank Peterson. We believe Hoskins was helping this individual to hide and that they may have been planning to perpetrate a similar horrible crime. Thanks to the heroic efforts of Detective Ralph Anderson and those with him, whatever plans they may have made did not come to fruition. He looked up at his audience soberly. Howard Gold and Alec Pelley died in Marysville, Texas, and we mourn their loss. What we and their families take comfort in is this. Somewhere, at this very moment, there is a child who will never suffer the fate of Frank Peterson.
A nice touch, Ralph thought. Just the right amount of pathos without getting all sloppy about it.
I'm sure many of you have questions about the events that occurred in Marysville, but I am not at liberty to answer them. The investigation, which is being jointly conducted by the Texas Highway Patrol and the Flint City Police Department, is ongoing. State Police Lieutenant Yunel Sablo is working with both of these fine organizations as chief liaison officer, and I'm sure that he will have information to share with you at the appropriate time.
He's great at this stuff, Ralph thought, and with real admiration, hitting every damn note.
Samuels closed his folder, lowered his head, then raised it again.
I'm not running for re-election, ladies and gentlemen, so I have the rare opportunity to be entirely honest with you.
It gets even better, Ralph thought.
Given more time to evaluate the evidence, this office almost certainly would have dropped the charges against Mr. Maitland. Had we persisted and brought him to trial, I'm sure he would have been found innocent. And as I hardly need to add, he was innocent, according to the laws of jurisprudence, at the time of his death. Yet the cloud of suspicion over him, and consequently over his family, has remained. I am here today to dissipate that cloud. It is the opinion of the district attorney's office and my personal belief that Terry Maitland had nothing whatsoever to do with the death of Frank Peterson. Consequently, I am announcing that the investigation has been reopened. Although it is currently concentrated in Texas, the investigation in Flint City, Flint County, and Canning Township is also ongoing. Now, I will be happy to take any questions you may have.
There were many.
5. Later that day, Ralph visited Samuels in his office. The soon-to-be-retired DA had a bottle of Bushmills on his desk. He poured them each a knock and raised his glass. Now the hurly-burly's done. Now the battle's lost and won. Mostly lost in my case, but what the fuck? Let's drink to the hurly-burly.
They did so.
You handled the questions well, Ralph said, especially considering the amount of bullshit you slung around.
Samuel shrugged.
Bullshit is every good lawyer's stock in trade. Terry's not completely off the hook in this town and never will be. Marcy understands that, but people are coming around. Her friend, Jamie Mattingly, for instance. Marcy called to tell me that she came over and apologized. They had a good cry together. It's mostly the videotape of Terry and Cap City that turned the trick, but what I said about the prints and DNA will help a lot. Marcy's going to try to stick it out here. I think she'll succeed.
About that DNA, Ralph said. Ed Bogan in the serology department at General ran those samples. With his reputation at stake, he should be squawking his head off.
Samuel smiled. He should, shouldn't he? Except the truth is even less palatable. Another case of footprints that just stop, you could say. There was no exposure to UV light, but the samples began developing white spots of no known origin, and now they're completely degraded. Bogan got in touch with State Police Forensics in Ohio, and guess what? Same thing with the Heath Holmes samples. A series of photos shows them basically disintegrating.
A defense attorney would have a ball with that, wouldn't he? And the witnesses? Bill Samuels laughed and poured himself another drink. He offered the bottle to Ralph, who shook his head. He was driving home. They were the easy part. They've all decided they were wrong, with two exceptions, Arlene Stanhope and June Morris. They stand by their stories. Ralph was not surprised. Stanhope was the old lady who had seen the outsider approach Frank Peterson in the parking lot of Gerald's Fine Groceries and drive away with him. June Morris was the child who had seen him in Figgis Park with blood on his shirt. The very old and very young always saw most clearly. So now what?
Now we finish our drinks and go our separate ways, Samuel said. I just have one question.
Shoot. Was he the only one? Or are there others? Ralph's mind returned to the final confrontation in the cave and to the greedy expression in the outsider's eyes as he asked his question. Have you seen another one like me somewhere?
I don't think so, he said. But we'll never be completely sure. There might be anything out there. I know that now.
Jesus Christ, I hope not.
Ralph made no reply. In his mind, he heard Holly saying, there's no end to the universe. September 21st. 6. Ralph took his coffee with him into the bathroom to shave. He had been slipshod about this daily chore during his mandated time away from the police force, but he had been reinstated to active duty 2 weeks before. Jeannie was downstairs making breakfast. He could smell bacon and heard the blare of trumpets that signaled the beginning of the Today Show, which would open with the daily budget of bad news before moving on to the celeb of the week and many ads for prescription drugs. He set his coffee cup down on the little table and froze, watching as a red worm wriggled its way out from beneath his thumbnail. He looked in the mirror and saw his face changing into Claude Bolton's face. He opened his mouth to scream. A flood of maggots and red worms poured out over his lips and down the front of his shirt. 7. He woke, sitting up in bed, heart pounding in his throat and temples as well as in his chest, hands plastered over his mouth as if to hold in a scream, or something even worse. Jeannie slept on beside him, so he hadn't screamed. There was that. None of them got in me that day. None of them even touched me. You know that. Yes, he did. He had been there, after all, and he'd had a complete and overdue physical checkup before resuming his duties. Other than slightly elevated weight and cholesterol, Dr. Elway had pronounced him fine and fit. He glanced at the clock and saw it was 4:15. He lay back, looking up at the ceiling. A long time yet until first light. A long time to think. 8. Ralph and Jeannie were early risers. Derek would sleep until he was rousted at 7, the latest he could be allowed to sleep and still make the school bus. Ralph sat at the kitchen table in his pajamas while Jeannie started the bun and put out boxes of cereal for Derek to choose from when he came down. She asked Ralph how he'd slept. He said fine. She asked him how the job search for Jack Hoskins' replacement was going. He said it was over. Based on his and Betsy Riggins' recommendations, Chief Geller had decided to promote Officer Troy Ramage to Flint City's 3-man detective squad. He's not the brightest bulb in the chandelier, but he's a hard worker and a team player. I think he'll do. Good. Glad to hear it. She filled his mug, then ran a hand down his cheek. You're all scratchy, mister. You need to shave. He took his coffee, went upstairs, closed the bedroom door,
and pulled his phone off the charger. The number he wanted was in his contacts, and although it was still early, today's opening trumpet flourish was still at least a half hour away. He knew she would be up. On many days, the phone at her end never got through the first ring. This was one of them.
"Hello, Ralph."
"Hello, Holly."
"How did you sleep?"
"Not so well. I had to dream about the worms. How about you?"
"Last night was fine. I watched a movie on my computer and corked right off. When Harry Met Sally. That one always makes me laugh."
"Good. That's good. What are you working on?"
"Mostly it's the same old, same old." Her voice brightened. "But I found a runaway from Tampa in a youth hostel. Her mom has been looking for her for 6 months. I talked to her, and she's going home. She says she'll give it one more try, even though she hates her mother's boyfriend."
"I suppose you gave her bus fare."
"Well,
you know she's probably smoking it up right now in some bumblefuck's crash pad, don't you?"
"They don't always do that, Ralph. You have to..."
"I know. I have to believe."
"Yes."
Silence for a moment in the connection between his place in the world and hers.
"Ralph," he waited. Those things that came out of him, they never touched either one of us. You know that, don't you?"
"I do," he said. "I think my dreams mostly have to do with a cantaloupe I cut open when I was a kid and what was inside. I told you about that, right?"
"Yes."
He could hear the smile in her voice and smiled in return as if she were in the room with him. "Of course I did, probably more than once. Sometimes I think I'm losing it."
"Not at all. Next time we talk, it will be me calling you. After I dream, he's in my closet with Brady Hartsfield's face. And you'll be the one to say you slept fine."
He knew it was true, because it had already happened.
"What you're feeling, and I'm feeling, that's normal. Reality is thin ice, but most people skate on it their whole lives and never fall through until the very end. We did fall through, but we helped each other out. We're still helping each other."
"You're helping me more," Ralph thought. "You may have your problems, Holly, but you're better at this than I am. Far better." "And you're all right?" he asked her. "I mean, really?"
"Yes, really. And you will be."
"Message received. Call me if you hear the ice cracking under your feet."
"Of course," she said. "And you'll do the same. It's how we go on."
From downstairs, Jeannie called. "Breakfast in 10, honey." "I've got to go," Ralph said. "Thanks for being there."
"You're welcome," she said. "Take care of yourself. Be safe. Wait for the dreams to end."
"I will."
"Goodbye, Ralph."
"Goodbye." He paused and added, "I love you, Holly." But not until he ended the call. It was the way he always did it, knowing if he actually said it to her, she would be embarrassed and tongue-tied. He went into the bathroom to shave. He was in his middle age now, and the first speckles of gray had begun to show in the stubble he covered with Barbasol. But it was his face, the one his wife and son knew and loved. It would be his face forever. And that was good. That was good.
The Outsider, a novel, was written by Stephen King and read by Will Patton. It was recorded by Elliot Elsie at True Phonic Recording in Charleston, South Carolina. Editing and post-production by Mike DeCino and Steve Varna for Common Mode. Terry Hogan was the mix engineer. The associate producer was Tiffany Ferrari. The Outsider was produced and directed by Christina Zarafanidis. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. The Outsider, a novel, is available in print from Scribner. Also available from Simon & Schuster Audio by Stephen King. Mr. Mercedes, a novel, read by Will Patton. And Pet Cemetery, a novel, read by Michael C. Hall.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.